Proposed responses to climate change range from the simple and easy to the complex and far-reaching. As these efforts get underway, it's important to go in with our eyes open to avoid doing harm in our quest to do good. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, produced with USAID's Office of Conflict Management and Mitigation, we interview experts about backdraft, the unintended peace and conflict consequences of climate change responses. I'm Sean Peoples, and today I'm speaking to Kimberly Marion Suiza, Assistant Professor in the Department of Political Science at Northwestern University, about how representation, policies, and institutions impact the experience of people on the ground, as well as biodiversity conservation. Kim, thanks so much for sitting down with me today. I want to start by asking you about your research, which examines the interactions between institutions, norms, and justice in global forest governance. The focus on the politics of indigenous representation within this kind of governance, I think, is a good place to start. And so I first wanted to ask you how you came to this research.
I guess broadly speaking, I really care about how policies and institutions impact the experiences of people on the ground. So mostly I look at the justice experiences that forest peoples have in Southeast Asia. But I guess, you know, you could extract this to a broader scale and say, if we care about sustainable development, if we care about sort of the good life and what kind of a world we want to live in, then we really need to care about justice. And so I do a lot of work looking at how norms of justice are translated into practice, and what those norms mean for what kinds of justice are really possible. So, for example, if we think about justice just as a distribution, you know, what's fair based on our inputs, right? You give this, I give this, there has to be some distribution, and that's fair. Well, that really precludes a more holistic sense of justice where maybe there's actually a third person who needs to be involved in the distribution, but if we don't recognize that person, then there can be no justice. And so in that sense, you can get conflict, you can get security challenges, you can have exacerbated poverty or marginalization. We have to approach conservation and global environmental governance from the perspective of the invisible and the marginalized people if we want conservation to succeed. If we think that sustainable development is the goal that we want to achieve, we have to be radical in elevating those who have traditionally been excluded. So how I got there was really thinking about how forest policies can actually change the dynamics in communities and produce conflict. And so thinking about, right, land tenure arrangements in Laos, where communities and individuals have no land rights, and the state owns all of the land, and it's in the Constitution, the 1975 Constitution, that the state really is sort of the keeper of the land, and they're supposed to manage it for the public good. But when you have new, right, market pressures coming in and interventions like REDD+, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, you have to, in some way, be able to say who gets what benefits and who's responsible for managing the lands to reduce emissions from deforestation. And it's in that allocation of property rights, which is the distributive justice question, that then conflict can actually be sparked. And what there are data that show that social capital in these communities is breaking down. Traditional conflict resolution mechanisms are no longer working because that social capital is fleeing. And so that's where I started. And then I started to think, well, how do you actually solve those problems? And how do you talk to people, conservation organizations, in a meaningful way about what they're doing? That can help them think more productively about why they're doing the kind of work they're doing and how do they approach it. And I think if you approach it from a justice perspective, you can really build on the moral obligations that we have as global citizens to conserving things in a more just way that works for everyone. And what conservation means to you and I here in the United States may be very different to what conservation means and looks like to people all over the world. But it doesn't mean that those are irreconcilable differences, right? It's about bringing together those diverse views and thinking through how do we integrate and build upon our strengths together rather than sort of piecemeal our approaches and struggle over resources.
So when using this justice frame, what are the important questions to ask?
The question we need to ask is, what are the politics of difference at play here? And by politics of difference, I mean, to what extent are different ways of living, different ways of understanding the world, different values, different orientations and different ideas, how do those all play into the way that we as human beings interact? So it's a relational thing. How does difference play into our relations as human beings? And that will then affect how we make decisions about our natural resources. And the way I think that you can get to a politics of difference approach is through a justice lens that says, okay, if we want to really recognize difference and think about leveraging difference for better outcomes, then we need to ask the question of who is at the table and who's not at the table, and who do we not even know that exists that maybe we wouldn't even know to ask them to the table. And the next question, though, and I think this is really critical, is that how the table is designed and constructed is really critical. And so it could be you and I are inviting people to our table, but that table may not actually facilitate voice in those contexts. And so I think, you know, the two questions are, who gets to design the table, and how do we find those who we otherwise would not know exist that should be helping design that table? If that may, and in that sense, I think you can get to this more radical, and radical, I mean, in the most positive sense, right? That this is a good thing, but really turning the tables on and bringing the less powerful to a level that is enabling of the capabilities to engage meaningfully in decisions.
Backdraft, this idea we're exploring in this podcast, looks at the unintended consequences of climate change responses and some of the important factors to consider, you know, when developing smarter policies. I believe greater participation within this space can help uncover some of the unintended consequences. So I wanted to ask, within your work at a practical level, how do we implement this idea of a greater and more representative participation?
So I think one thing that we're trying to talk about is using decolonizing methodologies in our research, both as a scholar, but also as practitioners, which means meeting people where they are. When you're thinking about designing a project or you're thinking about targeting specific communities that have come up in some analysis that you've decided that this is the community we want to work in, instead of coming in sort of with a project in mind, going and meeting communities where they are, and really understanding whether or not they even want you there. And if they do want you there, what are the mechanisms and norms and protocols by which that community wants outsiders to engage with them? And I think that does a couple of things. One is that if you're a donor, you're getting buy-in, right? And you care about buy-in because that affects the long-term legitimacy and effectiveness, right? Your donor dollar goes further where you have community buy-in. I think it does another thing, and that is it actually helps to strengthen both individual and collective voice within these communities. It's small, right? Nothing is necessarily revolutionary, right? The scale that we're talking about for these communities, it's really these development interventions can come in and they can dramatically impact their lives in negative ways, but the positive gains are much slower, right? And over a long term. And so there has to be patience, both on the donor side and the implementer side, but also on the community side, to see how those benefits can unfold. And so one of, I think, the more concrete benefits that you could see is more voice and more political engagement of these communities that ultimately will be one of the best things that you could do for development. Versus sort of, and I don't think anyone suggests that development is intended on giving handouts. So in the backdraft sense, what we see is if we're not paying attention to that voice component, we're actually seeing some disempowerment happen, right? We've seen communities in the Kiatngong wetland, which is in southern Laos, who there were eight communities that collectively managed this wetland and derived both food and livelihoods from this wetland through fish and other frogs, insects, things, right, that they harvest. But once a development agency or a number of projects, it wasn't one, but many projects comes in and says, oh, we have to have land use planning and delineate the village boundaries. And then most of the wetland was given to one village. And then conflict ensued. And that's an unintended consequence of something that people had really good intentions with. But if you're not understanding how people manage a resource, who gets privileged through these processes, who gets marginalized, you really have the potential of this backdraft and conflict. And that's a much longer term development problem that you've now just sort of exacerbated.
For a practitioner who is going into a community that has traditionally been ignored, or when approaching underrepresented groups or marginalized peoples, what are some of the things that practitioners need to know? And what are some of the things they can seize as opportunities?
I'm doing a lot of theoretical work, and I think it speaks, the work that I'm doing on environmental justice on the more theoretical side speaks to a lot of what practitioners are actually trying to implement when they're using rights-based approaches, for example, or trying to operationalize equity, which is one Aichi target under the Convention on Biological Diversity. It's also part of this IPCC, the fifth assessment report, right, that equity is important. And I think recognizing that there is that understanding what equity requires, what equity demands as you're designing your projects and trying to design institutions is an institution of reflexivity within those projects that allows you to capture really what it is that people need and want. And I don't think it's merely a question of need, but I think it's a question of how can we use our projects to put people in the driver's seat of their own futures, right? How can they create the future that they want to make? It's bottom up, but also, you know, I was at this World Conservation Congress, and one metaphor that they used over and over again is this metaphor of the navigators, right? And that the navigators in some traditional island cultures in the South Pacific, right, really are using different resources to guide their ship. And that ship could be their community, it could be their nation state, it could be whatever. And so I think, you know, sometimes in some communities, bottom up is what you need. Sometimes in other places, you need a mixture of bottom up and top down. I think we traditionally are more comfortable with top down. We can sit in a nice office and make all these toolkits and plans, which I think can be really useful. But we need to start thinking about how do our projects either reify or shift the power dynamics within communities? And that if there isn't, there needs to actually be a shift, right, in some kind of way that communities actually can engage in more powerful ways in their political process. The other thing I would say that I've seen that an organization in Southeast Asia is doing, and it's called the Center for People and Forests, and they're doing this work on conflict transformation. And so recognizing that not all conflict is bad conflict. Conflict can actually be very productive. It can be a sign of a healthy society. I'm not talking about violent conflict here, but more sort of contestation, right? Development actors, we should recognize that sometimes we actually want to see that conflict. It's a sign of healthy democracy, right? You don't want to resolve all conflicts, right? And that's not us to decide whose job it is. But that some things we actually want to facilitate and we want to use. And this is why I like the Center for People and Forest framing of transformation. How do you leverage and transform conflict into something that translates into more positive outcomes for communities? So that's something I think I would urge practitioners to think about. When is conflict good, and how do we create enabling environments that allow the good sort of components of democracy to flourish? And I think democracy, and you've probably heard this from others, that democracy is not just one form, right, that we may see here in the United States. It can take many forms, but that ultimately is what we need to be moving towards in a lot of our development interventions, because that's about people accepting their obligations and responsibilities to the greater good, and being able to chart how they fit into the path, right, in a productive way.
How about implementation? What, in your opinion, given complexities and specific contexts, is an achievable first step?
I think there's a lot to be said for listening. And there are different ways that communities listen, that individuals listen, families, policymakers, and that one of the first steps that we could do that could be scalable is figuring out how to listen more and prescribe less. And that, you know, one thing that I've seen change over the last 10 years in global environmental policy realms, and there's still much more work to be done, but I've seen a dramatic shift in how knowledge, for example, is talked about. There's still a tendency to say knowledge needs to be based on scientific method, and there are some constraints, for example, with U.S. federal funding for projects, that if it doesn't meet certain scientific standards, that knowledge is not considered valid. That's problematic for a number of reasons. But there has been a shift now in global environmental policy realms that alternative forms of knowledge, alternative ways of knowing and thinking about what it is that knowledge is, can actually be quite diverse and valued. And I give that as an example to suggest that none of this is impossible, but that's a result of people listening, right? And listening around different kinds of tables and being in dialogue with one another. Where it wasn't merely, oh, well, we have to talk to this person, so let's check the box. And listening is hard, you know, especially when you're on short time frames and you're trying to, you know, when you're facing sort of imminent threats of climate change, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think we'll get where we need to be otherwise.
I'm wondering if you can give me an example at the global, institutional, or even regional level where some of the alternative forms of knowledge, or even those representing that kind of knowledge, have gained credence.
Right off the top of my head, this what we've seen happen in the IUCN, for example, in the IUCN shift, where, you know, 15, 20, 25 years ago, economic and social policy was not really part of operationally part of what the IUCN was doing. The IUCN is this quasi-intergovernmental, non-governmental organization that is quite significant in guiding the world on what needs to happen for that conservation to take place. Very influential. It has state members and non-state members. They just recently voted to allow indigenous organizations to have formal representation, which that alone... The vote to allow indigenous peoples to represent themselves through their own organizations that's a huge change that we would not have seen 5 or 10 years ago. So that's one example of some success. But the broader sort of landscape in which that vote happened was a shift to including and listening to social scientists, to indigenous scientists, to economists, to political scientists, to geographers, to hear about why the conservation objectives that conservation biologists or wildlife biologists, climate scientists, et cetera, why they couldn't achieve those things are largely a function of all these political complexities. So that, to me, that now that social policy is a central component of what the IUCN does, that's a result of listening.
I think your perspective is so important, and I'm just curious how your research has evolved and ways in which you may have changed given experiences.
You know, I started out in conservation, like thinking about biodiversity. I saw what was happening to people because we were trying to preserve biodiversity as somehow a separate thing from people. And that's not what biodiversity is. And I don't And I, you know, maybe this is an anthropocentric, it is an anthropocentric view, but our well-being as a planet, right, as people, as species, as nature, is dependent upon us being able to foster trust with each other, whether that's between human beings at an individual level or communities, but also with our planet and the resources that it takes. And I saw, I got really frustrated in biodiversity conservation because it wanted to erase people from that equation. And people have the most devastating effect, right, on these resources. So we can call people into check, but I don't think that that helps either, right? I think it really is, we need to reorient ourselves and rethink what our real values are and what values do we want to persist into the future. I saw these people, their lives were being devastated by well-intended biodiversity, a lot of integrated conservation and development projects, great intentions, devastating, right, unintended consequences. And that's, if you're really living at the subsistence level that a lot of the world is living on, they can't handle that kind of shock. And that's, we have an obligation, and I truly believe we have a moral obligation, because we benefit a lot from what these people do in their day-to-day lives. I think we have to be very careful about how we talk about these things and who has the knowledge that we need to affect change. And it's not always me. It's not always, you know, other PhDs, right? It's a lot of people who are living these experiences.
You've been listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.